A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been digging into something that sounds simple until you actually look at it. The principle in international law against collective punishment. He wanted to know where this comes from. Is it a Geneva Convention thing? Older? Newer? And then the harder question, what does it actually demand? Not the bumper sticker version, but the full legal picture. What counts, what doesn't, whether there are exceptions.
And the answer to that last one is going to disappoint anyone looking for wiggle room.
That's what I gathered from your stack of reading. Walk me through it.
So the plain English version first. Collective punishment means you punish a group for something an individual did. You impose penalties on a community to deter or retaliate against the acts of specific people within it. The law says you can't do that. Full stop.
And Israel's the country most frequently in the crosshairs on this one. The home demolitions, the movement restrictions.
Right, and we'll get there. But the principle itself is much older and broader than any single conflict. It didn't start with Israel. It didn't start with the 20th century even. What's interesting is how the legal architecture built up layer by layer, each treaty closing a gap the last one left open.
So, let's start with what it actually means in legal terms, because I suspect it's broader than most people assume.
Much broader. The instinct is to think criminal penalties. You can't throw a whole village in prison because one person from that village committed a crime. And that's true. That's part of it. But the ICRC commentary on the additional protocols says the prohibition covers, and I'm quoting here, sanctions and harassment of any sort, administrative, by police action or otherwise.
Administrative. So not just trials and prison sentences.
Collective fines, destruction of property, administrative detention imposed on whole communities, movement restrictions, curfews, checkpoints, closure of entire areas. If you're imposing it on a group because of what an individual did, it's collective punishment. The form doesn't matter.
That's already a much bigger net than most people picture. Where does the trail actually start?
1907. The Hague Regulations, Article 50. This is the first treaty codification, and it's specifically about occupied territory. It prohibits collective penalties against the occupied population.
What prompted that?
The Franco-Prussian War, mostly. Occupying powers had a practice of imposing collective fines on towns. Someone in the town resisted. The whole town paid. The drafters of the Hague Regulations looked at that and said, no, that's not how a civilized occupying power behaves. So they wrote Article 50.
Which only covered occupied territory. Not armed conflict, generally.
That's the gap. And it took two world wars to close it.
1949.
The big leap. The Fourth Geneva Convention, Article 33. This is the central provision. I'm going to read it because the language matters. No protected person may be punished for an offense he or she hasn't personally committed. Collective penalties and likewise all measures of intimidation or of terrorism are prohibited.
Two things jump out. Personally committed. That's the individual responsibility anchor. And then, measures of intimidation or of terrorism. They're linking collective punishment to terrorizing a population.
They saw them as the same thing, essentially. Collective punishment is a form of intimidation. You're not just penalizing people, you're sending a message to everyone else. And the drafter said, that's not a legitimate military purpose.
So Article 33 covers civilians in occupied territory and, more broadly, protected persons in international armed conflict. What about prisoners of war?
Third Geneva Convention, Article 87. Same principle. Collective punishment for individual acts is forbidden. And then you've got Common Article 3, which applies to non-international armed conflicts, civil wars, basically. It doesn't use the phrase collective punishment explicitly, but its prohibitions on violence to life and person and outrages upon personal dignity have been interpreted to cover it.
So by 1949, we've got the prohibition in international conflicts, in occupation for prisoners of war, and at least implicitly in civil wars. That's already a lot of ground.
And then 1977 closes the remaining gaps. Additional Protocol 1, Article 75. That's the fundamental guarantees provision. Lists collective punishment among the things you can never do to anyone in international armed conflict. Additional Protocol 2, Article 4, does the same for non-international conflicts, both adopted by consensus.
Consensus is notable. Nobody stood up and said, actually, we'd like to reserve the right to punish entire villages.
And that's part of why the ICRC now identifies this as customary international law. Rule 123 in their customary IHL study. It binds everyone, all states, all non-state armed groups, regardless of whether they ratified the specific treaties.
When did that customary status get affirmed?
There's a case from 1997 that's particularly instructive. The Priebke case, Erich Priebke, former SS captain, tried by a military tribunal in Rome for the Ardeaten Caves massacre. The tribunal explicitly affirmed that the prohibition on collective punishment was already customary international law during the Second World War.
So it's not a modern invention being retroactively applied. It was the law then, even if nobody was enforcing it.
Right. And that's the thing about customary law. It crystallizes from state practice and opinio juris over time. By the time you get to the post-World War I Commission on Responsibility, they're already listing collective penalties as a war crime. The statutes of the Rwanda Tribunal and the Special Court for Sierra Leone both criminalize it explicitly.
So the derivation is a century of treaty law layering on itself. 1907 to 1949 to 1977, plus customary recognition that makes it binding on everyone. That's the where it comes from, answered.
Thoroughly.
Now, the harder part. What does it actually require?
The core demand is individual criminal responsibility. You can only punish someone for something they personally did. The ICRC commentary says the prohibition is, in part, an application of Rule 122, no conviction except on the basis of individual responsibility. But it goes further than that.
Because it's not just about convictions.
A collective fine isn't a criminal conviction, but it's still prohibited. Destroying someone's house isn't a criminal sanction, but if you're doing it because their relative committed an attack, that's collective punishment. Administrative detention imposed on a whole neighborhood, same thing.
So the form of the penalty is irrelevant. It's the logic behind it. Punishing Group B because of what person A did.
And the ICTY made this very concrete in the Dalalek case. They were looking at internment under Article 78 of the Fourth Geneva Convention, assigned residence, essentially, and the tribunal said this is an exceptional measure that may never be taken on a collective basis.
May never. That's absolute language.
It is. And that's consistent across the entire framework. The UN Human Rights Committee, in General Comment 29, said states may in no circumstances invoke a state of emergency to justify collective punishment. This is considered a peremptory norm, jus cogens, no derogation permitted, ever.
So even if you declare a state of emergency, even if you're facing an existential threat, you still can't do it.
That's what the law says. Now, whether states actually comply with that in practice is a different question.
Let's get to the practice, then. The most prominent contemporary example.
Israel's punitive home demolitions. This is Regulation 119, subparagraph 1 of the Defense Emergency Regulations, which are British Mandate-era laws from 1945. The regulation allows the military commander to demolish a house if he's satisfied that someone who lived there committed an offense.
And someone who lived there doesn't mean the owner. It could be a relative, a tenant, anyone.
Right. And the Israeli High Court upheld this in Al-Amarin versus IDF commander in the Gaza Strip. The court said, essentially, that the regulation is valid and the military commander can order the demolition even when other inhabitants of the house had nothing to do with the crime.
So you've got a domestic court upholding a colonial-era regulation that appears to directly contradict Article 33 of the Fourth Geneva Convention, which Israel ratified.
Israel's position is that the Fourth Geneva Convention doesn't apply de jure to the occupied territories. They draw a distinction between territories that were under the sovereignty of a high contracting party before occupation, which the West Bank arguably wasn't. Most of the international community rejects that interpretation. The International Court of Justice rejected it in the Wall Advisory Opinion. but that's the legal argument Israel makes.
So there's a genuine legal tension here, not just a they're violating the law and they know it situation.
There's a tension, yes. But the critics' argument is straightforward. Regulation 119 is incompatible with Article 33. You're punishing people, destroying their homes, for an offense they didn't personally commit. The fact that the regulation predates the state doesn't make it compliant with treaty obligations Israel took on later.
And the deterrence argument, that demolishing the family home deters future attacks.
This is where the scholarship gets interesting. There's a 2023 paper by Dilberry and Micelli that modeled this. They showed that under certain conditions, punishing innocent group members isn't an error, it's a deliberate enforcement choice. If you can't identify the specific perpetrator, but you can identify the group they belong to, punishing the group creates an incentive for the group to police itself.
Which is exactly the logic behind collective fines historically. If the village doesn't turn over the culprit, the whole village pays.
And Richard Posner and others have argued this can be efficient deterrence. But here's the thing. International humanitarian law doesn't care. There's no balancing test. There's no military necessity exception. The prohibition is absolute. Even if collective punishment works as a deterrent, you still can't do it.
That's a pretty stark collision between legal principle and utilitarian logic.
It is. And I think that's why this remains so contested in practice. The law says one thing, clearly and absolutely. But states look at the security problem and reach for tools that the law forbids. And then they construct legal arguments to justify those tools.
What about the other practices that fall under this umbrella? You mentioned movement restrictions.
So if someone from a particular neighborhood carries out an attack, and the military responds by imposing a curfew on the entire neighborhood, that's collective punishment under the ICRC's reading. Everyone's freedom of movement is restricted because of what one person did.
That would mean most military occupation regimes have been in violation for decades.
That's exactly the tension. The ICRC commentary is quite clear. Administrative measures imposed collectively fall within the prohibition. But state practice in nearly every modern occupation has included some form of collective movement restriction. The question is whether state practice has modified the customary rule, or whether states are just violating it consistently.
Consistent violation doesn't create new law, though. That's not how custom works.
No, you need opinio juris, the belief that the practice is lawful. If states are doing it while insisting they're not doing it, or doing it under some other legal justification, that actually reinforces the norm rather than undermining it.
Because they're not claiming the right to do collective punishment. They're claiming what they're doing isn't collective punishment.
And that's where a lot of the legal debate happens, not over whether collective punishment is prohibited, but over whether specific practices qualify.
What about the human rights law side of this? You mentioned the Human Rights Committee.
Human rights law doesn't use the phrase collective punishment in the same way, but the same conduct would violate specific rights, the right to liberty, to a fair trial, to property, to freedom of movement. The gap is that human rights law applies all the time, not just during armed conflict, but its protections are structured differently. During situations below the threshold of armed conflict, where IHL doesn't apply, you'd have to piece together the prohibition from multiple human rights provisions rather than pointing to a single clear rule.
So there's potentially a protection gap in low-intensity situations that don't qualify as armed conflict.
That's an underexplored vulnerability, I think. The IHL prohibition is beautifully clear. The human rights law equivalent requires more doctrinal assembly.
You've been quiet for a while.
I was thinking about the Dilberry and Micelli paper. The thing about modeling deterrence, it assumes you can measure the effect, but how do you measure the radicalization effect? The family whose home was demolished, the neighbors who watched it happen, some percentage of those people are now more committed, not less. The model captures the deterrent signal, but not the counter signal.
And the law doesn't ask you to run that calculation anyway. That's what I keep coming back to. The prohibition doesn't say, unless the deterrence benefit outweighs the harm. It says no.
That's the absolutist strain in IHL that a lot of people find unrealistic. But the drafters had just watched what happens when you let military necessity override everything. The whole point of the Geneva Conventions is to draw lines that can't be erased by claiming necessity.
So where does that leave us? A prohibition that's absolute in theory, widely contested in practice, and legally circumvented through classification disputes rather than open challenge.
The classification disputes are where the real action is. Nobody stands up at the UN and says collective punishment should be legal. They say what we're doing isn't collective punishment. It's a legitimate security measure. It's individually targeted. It's proportionate. The norm itself is uncontested. What's contested is whether it applies to specific facts on the ground.
Which is a much harder argument to resolve, because it's fact-intensive, and every case is different.
Right. And that's where courts come in, or would come in, if there were effective enforcement mechanisms. The ICC has jurisdiction over war crimes in Palestine, but enforcement is another matter entirely.
I want to go back to something you said earlier about the ICRC commentary and curfews, because I think there's a detail there that most discussions miss.
I was just thinking the same thing. Hilbert, you actually have experience with this, don't you?
3 days. That's how long they argued about whether collective punishment should be its own rule or folded into individual responsibility. I was doing legal research for the ICRC customary IHL study back in 2003, not on Rule 103 specifically, but I was in the room.
3 days on a classification question.
The Swiss take their taxonomy seriously. The split was between the people who said, collective punishment is just an application of individual responsibility and doesn't need a standalone rule, and the people who said, no, it covers administrative measures that individual responsibility doesn't reach. The administrative camp won.
Which is why Rule 103 is broader than Rule 102.
Broader than most states are comfortable with. The thing that never makes it into the public debate is that the ICRC's reading means curfews imposed on an entire neighborhood because someone from that neighborhood committed an attack. That's collective punishment. Full stop. The Israeli High Court has never really grappled with that reading. They treat curfews and closures as security measures, not as penalties.
That's the classification problem you were just describing. They're not calling it punishment.
They're not. But the ICRC commentary doesn't care what you call it. It cares what it does. If you restrict the movement of 1,000 people because of something one person did, you're punishing those 1,000 people for something they didn't personally commit. The label doesn't change the effect.
That's where state practice gets uncomfortable, because every occupying power in modern history has done some version of this.
Every single one. The question the study wrestled with was whether that consistent practice had modified the rule, or whether it was just consistent violation. The majority view was consistent violation.
Which preserves the norm, but creates an enforcement gap the size of a continent.
I had a colleague who worked on the state practice section. He spent 6 months cataloging curfews, closures, collective fines, house demolitions. He said by the end he could predict the legal justification each state would use before he even opened the file. Security necessity. Proportionality. Not punishment, just temporary restriction. The words changed, but the pattern didn't.
Did any state's practice actually align with the rule as the ICRC reads it?
None that he found. Not one.
We've got a norm that every state agrees exists, that no state openly challenges, and that no state fully complies with.
That's about the size of it.
Which isn't unique in international law, honestly. The prohibition on torture is absolute too, and yet...
The difference is, nobody writes law review articles arguing that torture can be efficient deterrence.
Well, some people did after September 11th, and the legal debate got very uncomfortable very fast. But the norm held, the absolute prohibition didn't change, even when people were arguing for exceptions.
What happened with a colleague? The one cataloging state practice?
He quit. Went to work for a shipping company in Rotterdam. Said he wanted to spend his days thinking about containers instead of curfews.
That's a pretty strong verdict on 6 months of research.
He said the hardest part wasn't finding violations. It was finding states that would admit the rule applied to them at all. Everyone agrees collective punishment is illegal. Nobody agrees that what they're doing is collective punishment.
Which is exactly the dynamic we're seeing now.
It's the dynamic you always see. The law is clear, the facts are contested, and the institutions that are supposed to resolve factual disputes don't have the power to enforce their rulings.
Where does that leave us? A prohibition that's absolute in theory, widely violated in practice, and legally contested not at the level of principle, but at the level of classification.
The classification disputes are hard. In some cases, If you impose a curfew because you have intelligence that an attack is imminent from a specific neighborhood, is that collective punishment or is it a legitimate security measure? The ICRC commentary would say it depends on whether you're responding to a specific individual's act or anticipating future acts by unknown persons.
The temporal dimension matters. Collective punishment is retrospective. You're punishing Group B because Person A did something. A security measure is prospective. You're preventing something that hasn't happened yet. But in practice, the line blurs. A curfew imposed after an attack is retrospective, but it's also framed as preventing follow-up attacks.
The people under curfew experience it as punishment, regardless of how it's legally classified.
Which is part of why the ICRC takes such a broad view. The experience of the civilian is what matters, not the legal label the occupying power attaches.
If the prohibition is this broad and this well-established, why does it remain so contested in practice? Is it an enforcement problem, an interpretation problem, or both?
I think it's mostly enforcement. The interpretation is actually quite clear in the treaty text and the commentary. But there's no reliable mechanism for holding states accountable. The ICJ can issue advisory opinions. The ICC can investigate. The UN Human Rights Council can pass resolutions. But none of those bodies can make a state stop demolishing houses if the state is determined to continue.
The states doing the demolishing have their own domestic courts that validate the practice under domestic law.
Which creates a parallel legal universe. The international law says one thing, the domestic court says another, and the domestic court has the police and the military to enforce its rulings. The international tribunal doesn't.
The practical answer to what does the principle demand is, it demands what it's always demanded, but whether anyone has to comply depends on whether anyone can make them.
That's the realist answer. The legal answer is simpler. It demands that no one be punished for something they didn't personally do, in any form, under any justification, ever.
That simplicity is exactly why it's so hard to enforce. Absolute rules generate absolute resistance.
They do. But the alternative, letting states balance away the prohibition whenever it's inconvenient, that's not a prohibition at all. That's just a suggestion.
The drafters of the Geneva Conventions had just watched what happens when everything is a suggestion.
They'd seen the Franco-Prussian War, two world wars, collective reprisals, hostage-taking, mass punishment of civilian populations. They knew exactly what they were prohibiting, and they chose to prohibit it absolutely.
The open question going forward is whether the gap between the law and the practice eventually forces a reckoning, either stronger enforcement mechanisms or a formal re-examination of what the rule covers. As urban warfare and occupation continue, the tension between security measures and the absolute prohibition is only going to intensify.
The human rights law gap, situations below the threshold of armed conflict where IHL doesn't apply, that remains underexplored. If you're in a situation that's not quite an armed conflict, but involves systematic collective penalties, you're piecing together protection from half a dozen different human rights provisions rather than pointing to one clear rule.
If you want to dig into the primary sources, the ICRC customary IHL database has Rule 10.3 and state practice. We'll link it in the show notes.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop.
This has been My Weird Prompts. You can find us at myweirdprompts.com or email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.